Hey, we get it. You don't want to be hearing a Progressive commercial right now. So let us tell you something you do want to hear. No one is funnier than you. People laugh just thinking about the things you've said. I'm laughing at one of them right now. Coworkers repeat your jokes at the office, but they're never as good as when you tell them, and shame on them for trying. There. Don't you feel better? You'll also feel better knowing you could save when you bundle home and auto with Progressive. Although I'm sure you'd have a funnier way to say that. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company affiliates and other insurers. Bundle discount not available in all states or situations.
HD Smartcast.
You are listening to a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Hi everyone. Welcome back to Delhi Decoded. I'm Pritika Khanna, your host, and I'm here with your weekly update from the national capital. In this podcast, each episode, we pick a pin code from Delhi and dive into the most famous buildings, landmarks, and stories from that pin code. For those of you who are from Delhi, I'm sure you have some very special memories from these places. For those of you who aren't, don't worry, I'll help you get a peek into the pulse of Delhi.
Hamari apni Delhi.
What would a disaster for a school child be? While most of us would think about prepping students on how to deal with disasters including earthquakes and floods, it is equally important to prepare them for disasters that can happen in their day-to-day lives, starting from road safety, air pollution, and other epidemics. SEEDS, Sustainable Environment and Ecological Development Society, is a not-for-profit organization that works with communities to find practical solutions in areas of disaster readiness, response, and rehabilitation around disasters for over 25 years. They started the Honeywell Safe School program from 110092 and other parts of East Delhi as a pilot project. According to them, a place like East Delhi has a mix of daily stresses and disaster risks, which provides a great platform for a holistic school safety initiative. This program has now been extended to Dehradun and Haridwar in Uttarakhand. In Delhi, this program has already reached 52,000 children, 45,000 parents and 2,200 teachers across 50 schools in East Delhi. I have with me Anshu Sharma, co-founder of SEEDS, who talks about the Safe Schools program and what it means for children. Hi Anshu, thank you so much for joining us on Delhi Decoded today.
Thanks Pritika, it's a pleasure being here.
So let's get straight on to the questions. Can you tell us a little bit about the Safe School program?
Sure. So, Pritika, let me start from where we come from and how we got into this program. So, I work with SEEDS, which is a nonprofit that has been working in the area of disaster management for the last 25 plus years. And we come from a background of architecture and planning. So, we focus a lot on buildings, at least in the early years we used to. And a major part of our work is responding to disasters. So wherever there's a major disaster, we extend relief support, we do reconstruction activities, buildings, including houses and schools. And in the course of the early years of our work, we were quite shaken with the kind of damages we would see around us in these disasters. So we worked in Orissa after the 99 super cyclone, we worked in Gujarat after the 2001 earthquake, the Andaman and Nicobar Islands after the 2004 tsunami and earthquake, Kashmir after the 2005 earthquake. And in that period, you know, that decade, there were a large number of earthquakes and cyclones. And in particular, earthquakes caused a lot of building damage. Now, in all the damages we saw, the most heartbreaking was the damages that we saw in schools. And the lives we saw lost in school building collapses. I can never get it out of my mind, the kind of devastation that was there in Gujarat after the 2001 earthquake. It was the 26th of January, an early morning when the earthquake struck. So the kids were in school, either doing the celebrations for the day, which was the Republic Day, and or they were taking out, you know, marches in these narrow lanes when the buildings around them just shook and collapsed. One particular site I remember was in Anjar. About 400 children were just buried in the rubble along with their teachers. And we were there after a couple of days and still, you know, The destruction was so widespread. The machinery was so difficult to come by. With their bare hands, the parents and the local community were trying to remove this heavy rubble and pull the children out. They could rescue only a few. After 2-3 days, the sounds that were coming from inside, they started fading away. Then the whole place started smelling really bad. And for many of us who stood there, you know, in front of that building, we can never get that feeling. We can never get that smell out of our minds. And it seemed such a huge waste. You know, these lives were just lost for nothing because our building standards and building codes were not being properly met and followed. So while on one hand, since we respond to disasters, in these last 20 odd years, we've rebuilt more than 100 schools that were damaged by disasters. But our hearts stay in, trying to be there before the earthquake or the other disaster happens, before the school collapses on children. So we try to do our own technical research to identify where the hotspots are. We've carried out intense programs in Himachal Pradesh, Uttarakhand, in the northeastern states, in Gujarat, Andaman and Nicobar Islands, Kashmir, Bihar, and Delhi, where we are currently also working. So that's basically the background of how we arrive at this. But of course, there are various kinds of disasters. This was just an entry point for us. And currently the program, so our flagship program right now runs in Uttarakhand and in Delhi. It's supported by Honeywell, so we call it the Honeywell Safe Schools Program. And this is in partnership with the government of Delhi and the East Delhi Municipal Corporation. So we work in about 50 schools. We work on structures, we work on, building capacities with children, their parents, their teachers, and we also involve neighbors as a community in that process.
So you mentioned that it covers a whole range of disasters. What kind of disasters are covered in this program?
Okay, so what happens is, when we use the word disaster, for a lot of people, the imagery that comes up is, as I said, big, one-time, huge Absolutely. Impact disasters like earthquakes and cyclones. In our science, we call them rapid onset disasters. They unfold very, very quickly. They are also called high impact and low probability disasters. They happen once in a while, but then they come with a huge impact. So that's our starting point that gets a lot of people, engaged, and that's a huge need to address. But at the same time, over the years, we've learned, talking to children and their parents and teachers mm-hmm. that very often people are more concerned about their day-to-day risks, which we call stresses. So we work on shocks and stresses. Mm-hmm. Now, stresses are things that affect us on a regular basis. They don't make headlines. They could be things that are actually at a very slow, constant pace, taking a toll. It's really alarming that over 30 children die in road accidents every day in India. And over a span of years, just in Delhi, over 100 children lose their lives. And almost all of these are avoidable. It's really frustrating to the point that, there are these studies which are called black spot studies that tell you which are those crossings or intersections, sections of roads where most accidents repeatedly happen. So in theory, we can even tell you where a bulk of these lives over the next, day or month or year will be lost. We are looking at the fact that, one in every 20 children in the country has a disability. So that would put the number of children with disabilities at over 100,000 in Delhi. But you don't see them on the road. When you move around, it seems like, no, it's not so high. Yeah. And that's partly because a lot of the children with disabilities they're not able to come out of their homes. And a lot of these disabilities are not very visible, locomotor disabilities. So we are working with disabilities and how these children should cope with life and with disasters in their lives. Okay. There are issues of abuse, there are issues of harassment, there are issues of mental health which are not visible, they can't be photographed, and these are also getting included. So that makes the whole basket of the kind of risks. So when we talk of these issues, we in fact drop the term disaster. We talk about what kind of a risk will your child, face when he or she steps out of their house, or at times even within the house, and we try to work around those.
But could you just help me understand a little bit on how do you go about, because there'll be children of all ages. So what is the program like for a school student in school? because it also covers a whole range of issues.
Yeah, so there's a whole range of issues, and thanks for catching on to this. You know, it's a very nuanced thing. And besides the issues, there's different absorbing capacity. There's a huge difference between children every two grades when you start talking to them. And also their abilities to do certain tasks. So all of this put together becomes a much wider canvas than, you know, just assuming that you can go to a school and start talking about disaster risks. The other thing also that happens is that kids are already so burdened, overburdened with their curriculum and so many extracurricular activities mm-hmm. that are being imposed on them. They're also fighting the smoke and the crackers and the plastic. So how much can you load them with? So we have to package this in a way that would be engaging, that children would see value in and feel, you know, charged up about taking on, that transfers life skills in an easy way and is easy to absorb. Internally, we have to divide this in a number of different slices that would appeal to that age bracket and in the format that we can run it. Most of these schools that we work with are in relatively lower income communities. They are all of them are government schools. And we have to calibrate how much of access, for example, to, you know, online facilities and resources can be made possible. So it's a highly calibrated program with different capsules and modules for every kind of a children's group that we work with, including the children with disabilities.
Okay. So approximately how much, sort of in like a month, how much time would a school child be spending, say a class 6 student be spending on a program like this?
So that's a question where we are trying to make the lines very fuzzy and blurred. So what we are trying is that it doesn't become a separate slot that a child has to, identify and work with. To give you an example, in fact, in the last 2 years, we've even been trying to work on the curriculum. So if I can tell you, you know, like, of course, everyone assumes that if you're going to talk about disasters, it may fit into a geography lesson because you talk about the earth and tectonic plates, a very obvious one. But we've been trying to, you know, put droplets of this into every kind of a subject that is being talked about. So, for example, in mathematics, if you're going to talk of Doppler effect and you talk about two trains approaching each other from two different stations at particular speeds and when they will cross, it could very easily be converted into water flowing downhill from a dam or a cyclone of a certain speed coming in from the ocean onto land and stuff like that. So we are working with actually a number of state governments right now because the curriculum is a state issue, and we're working with teachers and parents to see how it becomes truly an ingrained life skill. So to your question, there are still drills, mock drills that we do once in a while. There are still some exercises that we do which probably would not take more than 10-15 minutes of a kid's time in a day. But we are trying to make our way into their way of thinking so that it's constantly there. It's there in every period in some way or the other without them realizing that, you know, we are learning disasters as a science.
That's very nice. What has the impact been so far of this program in terms of the number of schools and students that you've reached out to?
So we work... In fact, if I could break this down, there's an easy answer to your question in terms of the numbers of children. We are currently working this. The Honeywell Safe Schools program touches 150 schools. That is across Delhi and Uttarakhand. There's over 50 schools that we are working with in Delhi. And then we also work with some other schools in Delhi. We constantly keep doing programs that engage other schools, including private schools, through quizzes and other activities that we do with them. So within these 50 focus schools in East Delhi, we have over 100,000 people that we reach out to. There's more than 50,000 children and then their parents and teachers and people from the neighboring communities. So that's, but then in our own understanding over the years, we've started seeing these numbers more as output numbers. And when we talk of impact, you know, if you are able to educate one batch of children in a school on how to respond to an emergency that may unfold around them, and they can actually save lives of people around them if they have the right skills, and also how to anticipate what can go wrong so that they can choose safer pathways, they can avoid risks, they can lead a safer life. that would have a huge impact for the entire life of that child and his or her family and people around him. So it's a very challenging question, and we are sort of grappling with how do you determine the impact of a child being taught and being convinced about leading a safer life. And we don't have numbers, but I think the it's an evolving science, and we are also trying to get our handles on that, on how. But we do believe that there's a very, very deep impact that any program of this kind makes. We are one of many agencies and many people who do this work. And I really feel that the impact equation would justify investing a lot more in our children and their future and their safety than we do at present.
Absolutely. I'm sure you've seen some sort of behavioral change that's happened on the ground. Has something that, you know, that is a part of the program been, have you seen some sort of change on the ground that's happened?
So there could be a number of things that we can, you know, look at in terms of change. I think the most powerful one for us is something that you can't easily photograph or document, and that is a change in mindsets. You know, when we talk of a lot of things that can go wrong, and we have to do it very sensitively, you don't want to paint a gory picture, but when the children's eyes just widen and then they absorb it, and then a couple of days later someone will come back and raise a question or say something and, you know, tell you about how they went back home and spoke to their families or their mother or sister, and there was a conversation at home. That for us is the most rewarding thing, because if we change mindsets, then we draw very long-term returns on this little investment that we are making. So there's so many instances on how, related to issues around fires and being able to get out of buildings quickly, on issues related to the kind of risks that happen every year during this post-flood, post-monsoon period, you know, when the diseases come in, when the air pollution comes, the kind of conversations we are seeing children have around air pollution at this time, which was not happening 2 years ago, is the return that we see on this in a very big way. The pollution conversation reminds me of an anecdote that here. So as part of this diffused day-to-day risk thing, we've been talking a lot about the environment and pollution and our contribution to climate change. So what we have in these schools is, we call it a carbon calculator. It's like a device installed on a wall, which is a game thing. You answer a few questions on your lifestyle. You know, how do you take a bath? How do you travel to school? How do you wash your clothes? And for every option that you choose, you score a certain number. And in the end, your total number tells you what your footprint on the environment, your ecological footprint is. So if you use a washing machine, and if you take a tub bath or a bucket bath, and then you are keeping the tap on while you're brushing and so on, you drive to school in a car, you would add up as being someone with a very large ecological footprint. So very interestingly, it caught on really well. Everyone was having fun. The teachers did it, and we did it, and the children did it, for their dads and moms, and everything went off really well. A couple of days later comes a question, and I remember this very bright girl in the school stood up in a group, and she asked it, you know, she says, sir, when we do our calculation, actually we have a very small footprint, because, you know, the kind of communities they're coming from, they walk to school, they don't have washing machines, they honestly have a very small footprint in ecological. Because there's so much pollution around us, and we are being told to wear masks, and you know, we are suffering on that count, we are told to take all action against it. Who has the large footprint? Who's creating the pollution, and what are they going to do about it? And, you know, it took us a moment to absorb the question, and it was so interesting how that conversation then went into a whole domain of environmental justice and equity and social justice. And suddenly we thought, oh, we had come here to educate the children, but what we've got here is material that is shaping itself to talk about justice and make this a better city. And that, you know, was really powerful. Very difficult to quantify and to capture as an impact, but it tells you the story of how mindsets are being changed.
Absolutely. I think the carbon clock is something I think most adults can also use. We don't realize the impact. Why was East Delhi chosen as a location in the national capital?
When we talk of disasters, for us, there's a very simple equation that we use that there are two kinds of features we want to look at. We want to look at hazards, which could be natural or technological. You know, earthquakes happen, rainfall happens, leading to floods and so on. And then we look at vulnerabilities, which is an inherent weakness in our system or our community or certain buildings that would make it, you know, more prone to damage when exposed to a hazard. When a hazard plus vulnerability come true, that leads to equal to a disaster. Now, for us to choose East Delhi, when we were looking at Delhi and we were trying to zero in on where to start this whole story from. Delhi is a very big city and a very complex one. If you look at the hazard side, then East Delhi is an area that got developed and settled upon much later in the history of Delhi, because it was traditionally a floodplain of the river Yamuna. Now it is shielded by embankment, so we are safe from annual flooding, but otherwise it's been the floodplain. And so it is low-lying, and so even after the embankment, it is more prone to waterlogging than, say, South Delhi or Central Delhi. And then because of the river flowing there, below the ground for about 200 meters, there's alluvium that has been settled by the river. So you don't find any hard rocks if you start digging. In fact, you find water very quickly. As opposed to North Delhi or South Delhi, you would often see rocks very quickly, sometimes even coming out of the ground, you know, if you go to the Delhi Ridge areas or even near Nehru Place. So what that means is that any buildings that are built on this sandy kind of a ground with very watery kind of a mix is also highly prone to damage in the case of an earthquake. We use the term liquefaction, where the ground literally churns and becomes like a liquid and buildings can sink or tilt in that, as opposed to very firm ground, which is rocky. So whether you look at floods or you look at earthquakes, which are natural hazards, or you look at technological hazards like stampedes and fires, because the kind of development that is there in East Delhi is more congested, very high density, narrow lanes, fewer open spaces. And so from the point of view of the hazard, we found that there is greater chances of impact in East Delhi. And from the point of view of vulnerability, looking at the kind of communities, their profiles, the buildings, their densities, their conditions, we found the vulnerability is very high in East Delhi. And when we did a GIS, an entire mapping study using geographical information systems, a platform that we use to map and score risks for buildings, we found that a bulk of the schools that would fall in higher risk categories, the highest proportion is in East Delhi, and that took us to East Delhi.
Children becoming agents of change, because they're definitely the future, and I think right now is a time when I think there are very different kind of challenges that we can definitely see for the future. How do you see children play the role of change agents in such a time?
You're absolutely right. I think we all acknowledge that they are the future. And at the same time, unfortunately, we all also at the same time want to control them and through them control the future. And we kind of tell ourselves probably that we know what the future will be like and we are going to prepare them. And reality can't be further away from this. We know nothing about the future. We knew nothing about 2020 till, the first month of this year. We don't know what's going to happen next. We have no clue of what lies in the future lives of these children. So I think one, as you say, is how do they become agents of change? But I would even go a step further to say, how do we transfer control to them? It is their world that we are talking about, right? We are already reaping the good or bad of whatever we have sown. Now it's their world. So how do you mind? A few years ago, there was an international document. We had contributed something to it, a UN-backed report that had come out, very aptly titled, Let Our Children Teach Us. And again, the kind of anecdotes that we come up with through these courses of the project that we do, there's so much that the children come back with and they surprise us. They are asking questions that we hadn't even seeded in their minds. they're concerned about things that we haven't still conceived as issues to be talked about. And there's a lot that is going on in their head. So I think we need to not take upon ourselves to make them into something and to secure their futures, but give them that space and play the role of facilitators. I'm also reminded a few years ago, one of our academic gurus in the area of participatory assessment, Robert Chambers, based in the UK, had once proposed that in the parliament, there should be 5 seats reserved for unborn children. What he meant was not that you leave empty seats. He said there should be representatives who will speak for children who have not yet been born. So I think, instead of worrying about the parali this year and what happened, the farms and what's happening with the vehicles and how we switch to electric vehicles in the next 3 years, we need to move way ahead. We need to be talking about 2100. Kids you see in nursery and KG right now, they will be in their 80s in the year 2100. They will be alive. Our kids, our nephews and nieces and grandchildren will be walking this city and this earth and be alive. And it's a shame that we are nowhere talking about the year 2100. All our plans, whether it's the Delhi Master Plan or zonal plans, we are maximum going to 2020. Our vision documents are going to 2050. So, I'm sorry to say, but I think we are being very selfish in talking about our lifetimes. We are not talking about the lifetimes of these children. And some of the older ones are very capable of doing it for themselves. So, we really need to hand the mic to them and hand the baton to them.
Definitely. I think it's their world that, it's the repercussions of our actions that the children of tomorrow are going to face. So, they definitely...
And we need to trust them a bit more. They are far more capable than we give them credit to be.
True. That's a very interesting point that you make. And we really hope to see more inputs from children in policy making and definitely have more impact in that sense. Thank you so much for taking time out and joining us today and sharing such valuable input on the Safe School program and also on the larger impact that, what happens in schools can have on the world.
It's a pleasure being here. Thank you for having me over.
That's all from me this week. I'll be back next week with a new PIN code. Until then, please like, subscribe, and share this episode. We're always looking to hear your thoughts and suggestions. We're ever present on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at HD Smartcast. You can also reach out to me directly on Twitter at Kritika Khanna. Thank you so much for joining in. See you next time. Until then, stay safe and healthy.
This was a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
HD Smartcast.
I'm Annie Apple, and I'm here to invite you to come and listen to my new podcast series, Raising a Pro. It's the most intimate sports-related conversations you will hear. Each week, we explore the journeys of some of your favorite NFL players through the eyes of those that know them best. From Joe Burrow, DeAndre Hopkins, Myles Garrett, Ezekiel Elliott, Nick and Joey Bosa, just to name a few. With exclusive insights and information, we leave no stone unturned. Subscribe now to Raising a Pro on your favorite podcast app.